If you have a Bible, I'd encourage you to turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. We're going to pick up the narrative this morning, starting in verse 13. We're finishing our journey through this biblical book of wisdom. And here is where I feel like things get complicated, if this book has not been complicated enough. We've been asking, how can we live well in the midst of life's challenges and complexities? And the author of this book, and if you remember, there are two voices in this book. There is the author, and then there is this figure called the teacher. And the author of this book has wanted us to kind of sit at the feet of the teacher and learn and listen. And we've discovered that the teacher is very likely the biblical King Solomon, one of ancient Israel's most famous and successful rulers, widely regarded as one of the wisest individuals who has ever lived. And in this book, he has been warning us against building our lives upon unstable foundations. Really, what he's been doing is this. He has been knocking over our stuff. We have these shaky constructions that we've been built, that we've been building in our lives, these senses of meaning and purpose and identity. And kind of one by one, he's knocked over our towers. He knocked over the tower of pleasure. He said, hey, if you try to build a life on the pursuit of pleasure, it's going to come up unsatisfactory. He's knocked over the tower of career and work, saying, hey, even if you pour your heart and your mind and your soul into your job, it's going to leave you empty and bitter, and it's not going to fill that hole. You're not going to find true gain. He's taken a sledgehammer to all sorts of identities that we've built, whether they're built on kind of social status or wealth or even religiosity. And he says, guess what? That is not actually going to give you the resources you need to navigate life's trials and storms. And these are wise words, and it's good insight into the human condition. But as he's kind of been swinging the sledgehammer these last 8 weeks, there's something we need to talk about. Solomon is far better at deconstruction and demolition than he is at reconstruction. Indeed, the wisest man who's ever lived ends badly. He gets into this deep tailspin that he can't pull out from. And this is the shocking end of the story. The teacher gets lost in the darkness. Solomon ends his life frustrated with wisdom and defeated by the brokenness he finds in the world. Here he is in chapter 2, starting in verse 13. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet, I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will also happen to me. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is smoke. It is hevel. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance. Seeing that in the days to come, all will be long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. It is all smoke, it's all hevel, and a striving after wind. Walking the path of wisdom is no guarantee to a happy outcome. Sure, it might save you some pain and some heartache along the way, just like, you know, if you're walking through a dark, unfamiliar house with a flashlight, that'll save you kind of knocking your knees over into something or stumbling. But he's saying if a meteorite is barreling towards that house, flashlight or not, the end is the same, right? Woo, kaplowy. And Solomon throws up his hands and he's like, I don't get it. I never smoked. I stayed away from sugar and alcohol and red meat. I exercised regularly and still I got cancer. What was the point? Or how about this? I invested my heart and my soul into my kids. I gave them my focus and attention. I spent the quality time. I read the right books. I listened to the right parenting podcasts. I tried to teach them the ways of God and love and humility, but still they ended up a mess of addiction and dysfunction and broken relationships. If there are no guarantees and the heartache is the same, why did I try so hard? Wisdom is frustrating to Solomon. And the brokenness he sees in the world and in the human soul, it just ultimately defeats him. This is him in chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. He says, again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed. And they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead, who are already dead, more fortunate than the living, who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Solomon concludes that it was better to not have been born. That's bleak. He's torn up by the injustice and the pain and the suffering that he witnesses, and it breaks him. And it's interesting because you'd think that Solomon would have a different perspective because he's a person of wealth and power and influence. You'd think he'd have the ability to do something about the brokenness that he sees around him. You think he could do something to make right the wrongs. But even he can't seem to make the headway that he desires. And I think it's because that line between justice and injustice, it doesn't just run between us good guys over here and those bad guys over there. I think Solomon comes to discover that that line runs down the middle of each and every one of us. Honestly, we all know what we ought to do, give or take some of the details, but we manage at least some of the time to not do it. So Solomon gives up. He throws himself into a meaningless life of sex and debauchery. He marries over 700 women, and he hooks up with 300 honeys on the side. We call them concubines. And if you don't believe me, you can read the story in 1 Kings chapter 11. Solomon's heart wanders far from God, and he begins to worship the pagan gods of his many wives, even to the point that he engages in the barbaric ritual of child sacrifice. Better not to be born, remember? So the wisest man in the world, but he, in the end, entirely misses the mark. Smoke, smoke, chevel, chevel, says the teacher. Everything is utterly smoke. I've heard a bit of this perspective even in our day. I think of kind of some of the ways that folks talk about race relations in America. I once heard an interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates, and he was in that interview kind of channeling Solomon. I think it was very raw, and he's saying, I feel like things will never get better. We might take two steps forward, but then we'll go two steps back. And he's identifying with Solomon's heartbreak about what just feels like intractable brokenness and injustice in our world. And everyone's heart breaks over something. Our hearts might not break over the same thing, but we all feel sorrow and grief and anger about some injustice in our world. I know because of my kind of family story, my heart breaks for immigrants and for foreigners living in strange lands. I know others, Geneva's heart breaks for families that are hurt and broken, that are in need of healing and restoration. I know some of you have huge hearts for young moms that have find themselves unexpectedly pregnant and without support. There's all sorts of different things that break our hearts. Because you see, as humans, we have this universal longing for what is wrong in our world to be made right. We dream of a world at one, where things work out, and where we show kindness and honor the dignity of one another. We yearn for societies that function fairly and efficiently and to the profit of all. For communities where we don't just know what to do, but we actually do it. Like MLK, we dream a dream of justice. But some of us doubt whether this dream will ever become a reality. And there's times I read the book of Ecclesiastes and I want to yell at the author. I don't know if you've felt this in our journey so far, but why did we have to listen to Solomon yammer on for 12 chapters? Yeah, there's been some great lessons along the way, but where is the hope? What is he leaving us with? And I feel like the author actually defends himself at the end of this book in chapter 12. This is what he says. And I say he, I don't know, it could be she. We don't know anything about this author. Besides being wise, the teacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The teacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. The author is saying that Solomon's words are like a shepherd's staff with a sharp point, a goad at the end. And it hurts when it pokes us, just like it hurts when our towers get knocked down. But God can use that pain to ultimately steer us in the right direction towards greater wisdom. God can use Solomon's human insight to help lead us into God's way of life and truth. So what is the greater wisdom then? The author gives us the answer in the very last lines of this book. This is 13 and 14 in chapter 12. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. The author's good news is the promise of God's judgment. That might not strike you as good news, because when we hear the word judgment, our brains kind of instantly go to condemnation and punishment, to law courts and sentencing, to us standing before some stern-faced authority figure having to justify every poor decision we've ever made. But that is the wrong picture of God's justice. God's justice is not about the condemnation of people, but the condemnation of evil. His judgment is actually a rescue operation to restore life, beauty, and peace to the world. And the author of Ecclesiastes wants us to know that what gives life meaning is the hope of God's judgment. That one day God will just clear away all the smoke and bring true healing to our world. We take heart knowing that God sees the brokenness and has a passion to fix it. He's promised to make all things new, to wipe every tear from our eyes, to do away with evil. And according to the author of this book, that hope in God's coming justice should give us the fuel we need to live a life of honesty and integrity before God right now in this life, even as we're still puzzled by life's mysteries. So that's great. God will fix it. But it feels very theoretical. Where does this touch real life? And what do we do with the ugliness and the garbage in the meantime? Ecclesiastes doesn't give us that answer. But you know what? Jesus does. Jesus' answer is simple, but not simplistic. He invites us to see and engage with the world through faith. In the face of brokenness and injustice, we feel deeply. We mourn and we lament, but in the midst of our grief, Jesus invites us to know hope, to have hope, and to be hope. And we're going to spend the rest of this morning kind of unpacking what that means. But let's ask God to give us this perspective that Solomon was unable to find. May God's Spirit teach us how to pivot out of that grief into life and joy and hope. That which Solomon never learned. So in the face of the world's brokenness, Jesus invites us to know hope. Ecclesiastes tells us that to hope for God's judgment, to look ahead to our Creator's ultimate rescue of our world. But do you know that this divine rescue has a face? To know hope, you have to know Jesus, because He is the one who renews what is broken. This is how Jesus described His own mission in the Gospel of Luke. It might sound familiar. He says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because He has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." As the brokenness and pain of this world got you down, well, come to Jesus, because that is exactly what He came to heal, to make right the world's wrongs. And we forget how tangible His message is. It's good news for poor people. It's freedom for those in bondage. It's recovery for the sick. It's rescue for the oppressed. It's welcome and dignity to those who are far off and abused. And that's exactly what Jesus did. I love how N.T. Wright describes this in his book, Simply Christian. He says this, "Wherever Jesus went, he met an endless supply of people whose lives had gone badly wrong. Sick people, sad people, people in doubt, people in despair, people covering up their uncertainty with arrogance and bluster, people using religion as a screen against the harsh realities of life. And they all came to Jesus in search of hope. And what did Jesus do? He didn't wave a magic wand. He met them in their pain. He sorrows with us because he knows intimately the violence and the injustice and the tragedy that comes with living in this world. He's experienced that agony of soul and body that we all experience in our lowest moments. And he doesn't pretend it's not there. He doesn't try to put a happy face on it. He's lived it. He meets us there. But unlike Solomon, he can pull out and pull us out of that tailspin of despair. Because he's here to do something about it. Wright says again, he says, Jesus has come to take the tears of the world and make them his own, to carry them all the way for us to his cruel and unjust death on a cross. He's come to take the joy of the world and give it rebirth. The rebirth of joy, the rebirth of hope, because he breaks the power of evil, sin, and death when he walked out of his tomb. If you want to know hope, you got to know Jesus, because he is the true source of hope. He's the one who says, I come to make all things new. He's the one who said, I came that they might have life and have it abundantly. He's the one who declared that those who follow me will not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. That is our solution. First and foremost is to know Jesus and to know hope. But this isn't strictly an intellectual knowing or even an individual knowing. This is something that God intends for us to experience together. God's design for us is to know the hope of Jesus through this community that is filled by Jesus, that depends on Jesus, and that acts like Jesus out in the world. This is how we know hope. And it makes me think of a time, there was a, and I know I've mentioned this before, there was a time that Brianna suffered a miscarriage and we lost a baby. And I distinctly remember an awful piece of advice that we got from some well-meaning friends at church. They said, we're so sorry for your loss. Take whatever time you need to grieve. We'll be here for you when you get back. And initially, thank you. And then I sat with that and I said, wait, what? When the bottom falls out of my life, that's when more than ever I need to be here. I don't need an excuse to skip church. When tragedy strikes and that hope slips from my hand, I need to be next to someone whose hope is still strong. Now, it doesn't mean I think that they're going to fix what's gone wrong. You can't fix a cancer diagnosis. You can't fix a death in the family. You can't fix the sudden loss of a job. And we don't need people to say magical words of comfort that make everything all right. Because we can't do that. No offense, it's outside of our power. But when I'm lost in the dark, I might need you to direct me toward the light. In order for me to know hope, I may need you to point me to Jesus and help me get to him. Carry me, maybe. I think of the story of the paralytic who was carried by his four friends And they were so desperate to get him to the feet of the Lord that they literally broke through a roof to get their buddy at Jesus' feet. And do you remember what Jesus said? In that moment, he said, "It is by their faith that he is healed. There is power there." So when injustice and pain comes crashing in, we need to know hope. And that really means we need to know Jesus, and we need to know him together as a family that finds life and strength in him daily and practically and in the real ups and downs of life. So point number one is no hope. Point number two is have hope. Jesus invites us to have hope. And to have hope means that we see and engage with the world through faith. It's trusting that evil will not win no matter how bleak the news sounds. It's trusting that death is not the end despite its seeming finality. It's not giving in to despair because God can always bring beauty from ashes. He can always change hardened hearts. He can always heal age-old wounds. Having faith means choosing to dream God's dream of hope and justice, even when we're faced with the direst of circumstances. I'm a bit of a history nut, and it's been fun introducing my kids to different historical figures. And recently we've been talking about Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And I think his ability to steward hope was a great gift that he shared not only with the African American community and those who long for justice, but really with God's people. He was saying fire hoses and police dogs, arrests, even an assassin's bullet couldn't squelch his hope because he knew God's promise given through the prophet Amos that one day justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. People of God, this sort of hope needs to infect our thinking. It needs to affect how we speak about other people, about politics, about our hope for the world. Don't pronounce a verdict over someone or something that God has not pronounced. You might have a friend who's been demonized by addiction. You don't get to say that that person is hopelessly lost, because Jesus has not spoken that over that person. And also, we know a God who casts out demons. There is no room for cynicism or defeatism in the Christian life. So we need to be people of hope, but we also need to be a community of hope. We can't be a church that throws up our hands and says, you know what? Some of this poverty in the South Sound is just too intractable. It's too complicated. It's too broken. The system's messed up and we'll never be able to do anything about it. Is that what Jesus says? Sure, he says the poor will always be among you, but he says, I am the one who's come to proclaim good news to the poor and to instruct my followers to remember them in their struggle and to act with Christian generosity. We don't get Solomon's bleak, defeated perspective. We steward the hope that Christ has given us. And we see our world and our life and all of the situations in it through those eyes of faith. That God says, I am not content to leave them in the muck and the mire, but I will clean it up. I will fix it. I will make it new. So he says, no hope, no me. Have hope, as you navigate this life. And then finally, Jesus invites us to be hope. He calls us to play a part in the arrival of that hope in our world, to participate in bringing it about. Now, let me show you how this works. Jesus announced that the Spirit of the Lord was upon him to heal those racked by disease and infirmity. And that's what he did. He went around the countryside. He healed the blind, the lame, the deaf, the palsied, even lepers who were kind of quarantined as agents of infection and kind of outcasts from society. That was who Jesus was. It's who he is. He heals body and soul. Great. What does that have to do with us? We have the hope that Jesus can heal, but I can't in my own power touch someone and restore them to physical health. And in the face of a vicious, contagious disease or some sort of physical trauma, what can I do? The brokenness is too great. Jesus says, join with me and be hope. I'm going to share with you guys an illustration that I absolutely love. I think it's very telling, but I want to give a word of warning because it is possible for you to hear this illustration and not hear it. You might start to read our own experiences through it. You might think I'm trying to talk about masks or vaccines or something like that. I encourage you to actually hear what I'm saying and don't instantly go to kind of reading it through our lens. But I think that this is something that the Lord can speak to us through, and I, with a little fear and trembling, I want to navigate these waters. But please listen to what is said and not what is not said. The ancient world was terrified of epidemics, and rightly so. Disease would rip through their community. They would kill people by the thousands. And there's this guy named Dionysius of Alexandria who's writing in the 3rd century after Jesus. And he's telling about one particularly lethal plague that ravaged his Egyptian city of Alexandria. And he remembered how his pagan neighbors would, and this is him writing, thrust aside anyone who began to be sick and kept aloof even from their dearest friends and cast the sufferers out upon the public roads half dead and left them unburied and treated them with utter contempt when they died. In the face of such fear and callousness, Dionysius recalled the very many of number of Christians in that city, while in their exceeding love and brotherly kindness, did not spare themselves, but kept by each other and visited the sick without thought of their own peril and ministered to them assiduously and treated them for their healing in Christ. Those folks died from time to time most joyfully, drawing upon themselves their neighbors' diseases and willingly taking over to their own person the burden of the sufferings of those around them. 3rd century AD, the Egyptian church in a season of pandemic, and this is how they lived. And it caused a scandal to the point that it gets mentioned in non-Christian sources. You see, many Romans saw this sort of risky human intervention as a stupid sacrifice and a sign of weakness. Death is coming for us all, they said, and those dying wretches are not strong enough to fight it. So why step in and help them? But Jesus' followers disagreed. They said, no, 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 we know hope. We know the healer, and he has called us to love our neighbors. And he's commended us with this charge to look after the sick in his name. And in the face of an epidemic that they couldn't stop or understand, they chose instead to have hope and to be hope for their community. Now, this is a time of persecution. And in this moment, they start to set up these private homes that they called xenodokia, which are places to receive strangers. And they'd provide shelter there for the poor. They'd offer hospitality to pilgrims. They'd nurse and heal the sick. And those xenodokia, once Christianity gets officially tolerated by the Roman Empire, they come out into the open. And they become the first hospitals in human history. Christians establish a hospital in 369 in Caesarea, another one 375 in Edessa, a third in Rome itself by 390. And you see Christian patrons who donate all of their wealth to provide facility and services to care for those racked by disease. My wife today is a cardiac nurse at Good Sam. She works in the healthcare industry. It's her ministry and her calling to care for the sick. And today, with the advances of medicine and science, doctors and nurses can do the near miraculous for people who are battling illness or born with deformity or who have suffered trauma. But it's because thousands of years ago, before all the advances in knowledge and technology, a community like this, who loved Jesus and depended on him for life and strength, chose to act like Jesus and to be hope for their community. Again, I'm not talking about masks or vaccines or any of that, but hear what I am saying. Jesus says, even in incredibly difficult seasons, when you don't have the answer, we can be people who point to the answer and join with him to bring a little hope back into the world. Today we think of healthcare and we say, oh, that's the government's job. Actually, it took the church to teach the government what to do. That was God's people transforming a culture because they knew hope and they had hope and they sought to join with Jesus to be hope. And it changed our very society. Our ultimate hope is God's justice, that God will come and make all things right and new and beautiful again. But in the midst of the smoke, in the midst of the darkness, in the midst of the brokenness, he says you can already know hope through Jesus. And it can change your perspective. You can have hope. Sure, you'll still mourn and grieve and lament, but it'll give you the resources to not give up, to not despair. And in fact, it will give you the fire to join with me and be hope for a world that desperately needs it. This book actually ends with good news. Because in all of the brokenness and ugliness, what we need more than anything is God's justice. And God's justice comes in the person of Jesus. And the beauty of it is he took all the sin and junk that we rightly deserved and he took it on his own shoulders so he could condemn evil and save us. That's what we celebrated at the table. We've been washed clean. But now he's condemning evil and washing clean and trying to make new and beautiful again this very cosmos. New creation. The old is gone. The new has come. That's what we're looking forward to. To God's kingdom come, his will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And we can't be people who despair. We can't be people who give up. We can't be people who are all curmudgeonly and grumpy like Solomon. Because we know Jesus. and we can have hope. Let me pray. Lord, there is so many times that I feel like I move through life a functional atheist. I see the news. I see brokenness. I see pain. I see sin in my heart and the lives of others, and I give up. I assume that all we can do is cry and weep and mourn and feel shame. But you didn't leave us lost in the dark. You didn't leave us alone in the smoke. You are the one who will make all things new. May we cling to you. May you transform our minds. May they be renewed in your presence. And when you give us the resources to be agents of your hope, your optimism, your rescue in this world that is long lost hold of hope. We love you, Jesus. Amen.